privilege to have been invited to participate in this historic conference and in the world of outreach, the many, many different things that are done. Or Sameach in Yerushalayim, as many of you know, has the patent on one particular brand of outreach. Our students are primarily college-trained, very academic, disciplined, and they bring a wealth of experience from the academic world, and they're looking for something comparable or even better in Torah. And not everybody in the outreach world is as equipped to deal with that challenge, as is our guest this afternoon. Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb is known the world over, PhD in philosophy from Brandeis University, professor of mathematical logic at Johns Hopkins University, one of the shining Talmidim of the late Boston Rebbe, a close friend and esteemed colleague. He's here to answer your questions on outreach. We have approximately in an hour, so pace yourselves. Rabbi Gottlieb.
I just want to mention one thing before we get started with questions. When you are doing Kiruv, it could be in a classroom setting or it could be one-on-one, the basic format is you are giving and the other person is receiving. Some of you have read Rav Dessler's Kuntres HaChesed and you know that everyone wants to be able to give. It's tremendous satisfaction, tremendous reinforcement for your ego if you're giving. You put down the phone and feel that you really accomplished something. How does your student feel? After a while, your student can feel that I'm just a sink for pity or a sink for charity. You need to find ways for your student to feel that she also is contributing something, giving something, that you're benefiting from this interaction also. And not just by saying thank you, but to feel concretely. One way you can do that is when the student asks a good question, to say, wow, that's a good question. And from time to time say, I don't know the answer to your question. I'll look for it. I'll check with people and I'll get back to you next week. That way the student feels, so I'm contributing something also. You're learning something because you're talking to me also that you didn't know. And I would recommend even saying thank you and I don't know sometimes when you do know. When you do know. Look for ways that the student feels that the student is contributing to the interaction. Not just saying so, but concrete examples where the student can walk away, put down the phone and say, wow, I really did something. I really gave something. I really participated and produced something. The same satisfaction that your ego gets from giving, the student's ego will get from feeling that she also has something to contribute. And don't ever be afraid to say, I don't know. Chazal say, Lamad l'shon chalom or eni yodea, it is not a failure if you don't know. On the contrary, if you say, I don't know, it teaches. Number one, I don't have to have answers to all questions in order to be confident that what I'm doing is right. Number two, it paints you as honest. I go to poskim. When a poskim says to me, I don't know, then I pledge allegiance to him. Because it means when he tells me a psak, it means he really knows. If he never says, I don't know, then I wonder if sometimes he's just guessing. I don't know means I don't have an ego stake in showing myself to be perfect. All these things are worthwhile in a teaching setting. Okay, now, I'll be happy to try to do what I can for the questions that you want to ask. Yes?
So, in the chapter we always learned that silence is agreement. And in Kiruv, a lot of times the women are telling me things that are not okay. And I'm always uncomfortable with that. If I just keep quiet, is that okay? Halakhically, like, am I allowed to listen to this? Like, she'll tell me, oh, look, I got this great book in the JCC library, and it's she's talking to me about it. And meanwhile, it's not the Torah ideology, it's conservative, whatever it is. And I don't know. So, oh, you know, that's nice. You know, is that validating that? Yeah, but I know she's not ready to hear the Musar.
First of all, Shtika Kahodo Domi is a principle in Beis Din and only in Beis Din. So you don't have to worry about the legalities of it. Secondly, I think you're talking about an interesting and subtle point. We had an incident in Or Sameach where a boy came in, traveling through, they slept overnight. In the morning, when the roommate who came back from Shachris came, the new boy was standing there in front of the mirror, face lathered up. And half his face had been shaved with the stick razor, and he was holding in his hand. I guess the yeshiva bacha sort of looked surprised, and the fellow said, "Ooh, is there something wrong?" Now his face is half shaved. Lather on the other half, right? He's holding this razor in his hand. What should he do? So I don't know what he did, but he came to me afterwards and asked me what he should have done. I said, "You should have said to him, it's something to talk about. We'll get to it sometime later." You can't tell him, don't do it. Well, he's not going to walk out of the room half-shaved, right? Except to run away from you and go someplace else and shave. Right? You're not going to be able to stop him. So what you're telling him is, there is an issue. I'm not going to let that destroy our connection now. And it's something which we'll get to when we'll get to. And if she says to you, she's enthusiastic about this book, and you can hear from the description that it's not a Tory ideology, you can say to her, "Well, I'm happy that you found something that interests you on a Jewish level, and maybe sometime we'll talk about the ideas in it or the details in it." And just put it a little note that it needs to be talked about. That's enough that she will not draw the conclusion that you agree with that book or you agree with the ideas in that book. But you don't have to face it. You don't have to tell her it's no good. Just tell her something to talk about and leave it for the future. I mean, there was an attitude of great respect and reverence, and then all of a sudden the attitude changed.
Yeah.
This is one of your students.
It's a student of my husband's.
So this is an in-person student or over telephone?
In-person student. Right.
How long do they know each other?
Over a year.
I think in cases like that, now, of course, it's psychological and it's delicate. My tendency is always to go at it straight. I see that something is bothering you, something is disturbing you, something you're feeling something about us, about me, about our relationship. I'm open to hear whatever it is and discuss it with you, talk to you about it, and see if we can come to an understanding about it. And just open up and let the person. And if the person says no, it's nothing, then at least you opened and you made that gesture. And you show yourself to be concerned, sensitive, self-confident enough to be able to face whatever it will be. There's no reason to beat around the bush. No reason to hide from it. That's what I would say. Yeah.
I live in San Francisco, so something that comes up a lot. It's a very, very liberal society, and it's a very universalist society. So the philosophy of universalism is so pervasive. And I just would love to know sort of how to address it, how to go about it. If someone seems like if I've tried to approach it from various vantage points and it doesn't seem to be penetrating because it's so pervasive, then what?
Well, it's true. There are ideas. Kulam sheker, completely false. And they're very universal. No, I didn't say it here. I said it to the other group. I just said it. You have to only say that which can be heard. So sometimes you can sort of work around the edges of an idea. Now, I think universalism, it has a couple of different applications. One application is that everybody's really the same. You might try to use their own prejudices against them. I find this to be a very effective technique. Not everybody can use it. It depends upon your personality, how much you know about the secular world. But for example,
I would ask, do you think that cultures can benefit from one another? One culture could learn something from another culture? Now, a universalist is going to say yes. But then, if one culture could learn something from another culture, it means that culture A has something that culture B doesn't have. That's why culture B will learn it from culture A. That can be a bridgehead to talking about differences. Then you could talk about two different kinds of universalism. It's the same idea. If you want to have harmony in music, you can hire 100 violins and have them all play the same note on the same string. And you'll have harmony. But it's thin because it's all the same note. An orchestra isn't formed that way. An orchestra has 25 different instruments, and they make a rich, harmonic, integrated sound. That doesn't deny their differences. On the contrary, it capitalizes on their differences to create a richer harmony. So that's the way you could introduce the idea of distinctions between people and between cultures, in a sense which connotes the appreciation of all of them, even though you're not saying that straight out. But at that point, you can introduce the person to thinking about differences. Differences between cultures, differences between people, differences between capabilities, strengths. And in that way, you can break down at least one level of this kind of universalism. Now, the second level that we are an entirely different cut above, that's hard to address directly. But if the subject comes up, here is one way to at least introduce it. If you look carefully in the Derech Hashem, you'll see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu tried to reach all of mankind equally 4 times. And after being rebuffed 4 times, then he chose Klal Yisrael. For example, Adam and Chava. Had Adam and Chava succeeded in Gan Eden, there never would have been an upper group and a lower group. That would have been everybody. After Gan Eden, it says to Ramchal, everyone could have done what Avram Avinu did. Every person could have done exactly what Avram Avinu did, and all would have been equal. The door was open for everyone. Only Avram Avinu did it. That was at the time of the Dor HaFlaga. The nations were set up. But as time went on, any group from any nation could have detached itself from its nation and joined Avram Avinu. Avram and Sarah and Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, says the Ramban, made tens of thousands of Gerim. Tens of thousands. They got lost in time, but there were lots of people who did try to attach themselves. That's the third shot. When it came to Matan Torah, the Medrash says, and Ramchal takes it literally, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu went around to every Ummah and said, I'm offering you the opportunity to join Klal Yisrael, not in place of Klal Yisrael. That was never Hava Mina. But to join Klal Yisrael and stand, and everyone could receive the Torah together with Klal Yisrael. After being told no 4 times, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I need a permanent representative, which is Klal Yisrael, but the door is still open, and the best resolution for the world would be if all people would become Gerim. So what you see here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chosen resolution is everyone should be on the same level. Where we are in now is a default minimalist position. So that means that the distinction between people is not mitzad HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's mitzad people who have said, no, we're not prepared to do that. That, if a person is already open to hear, that's one way to put it, which is, of course, 100% amnesty.
It's very, very difficult because a bas mitzvah is, I would say, having gone through a bar mitzvah of that type, it's not primarily about the child. It's not primarily about the child. It's primarily about the status of the parents in their society. How much money can they throw? How big a bash can they have? Yeah, the kid will get up and say a few words, but that's not where it's at. The new outfits and the caterer and all the rest. After all, they have no ruchnius to offer. For many kids, that's the end of their Jewish attachment altogether. They prepare for the bar and bat mitzvah. That's it. It's over. And the bat mitzvah is at age 13. Because
can't make the boys different from the girls. Right? Or the girls different from the boys. I haven't dealt with this question. My only feeling is that a minor gesture, some minor element, for example, the girl is going to make a speech. So she suggests that maybe it would enhance her speech, would crown her speech, if she could put in a few quotes from classical Jewish materials. And then offer to study with the girl and give her something about gratitude to parents, something about gratitude to relatives, something about gratitude for health and so forth and so on. To express gratitude and find makoros and then give her a sefer with these makoros in it and learn it from the sefer so she'll have something concrete, something that she used, that she'll take away from her about this. Something like that. But beyond that, you can't challenge the spot. I mean, when if they're Jewish and they have a Jewish identity, they're planning on this. They've been planning on this for more than 10 years. You know, and they've been talking with her, and this one had this one, and that one, and that one rented that hall, and that one rented that hall. I mean, that's how it goes. That's,
but now they're part of our communities, and they want us to give their daughter a bas mitzvah. So we have to somehow, and we can't allow her to read from the Torah.
No, wait a second. I'm not getting the point now.
The girls now are part of H Detroit, and they learn in our Sunday school. But how can we help them understand that reading from the Torah is not, that's what they want. They feel that a bar mitzvah is reading from the Torah, like a boy. So maybe just some, like...
Thank you very much.
Just a derech of speaking to the parents, maybe, of how to explain...
Then I didn't understand the question. Okay, but now let me ask this. When you're coming up, let's say, to a bas mitzvah, do you have any requirement or any encouragement that the parents should attend classes also in preparation?
No.
Oh, but this is crucial. This is crucial. I remember I spoke at a Torah Masar convention many years ago, and I think some of them did adopt it. You have a child in your school. That is a golden key to the parents. Tell the parents, listen, your children are learning these things. Do you know them yourself? Suppose your child asks you for help with the homework. Do you know what it's talking about? You don't want the school to divide you from your child. You want the school to help cement the family in your relationship with your child. Have the parents come at least once a month and say, listen, we will go over with you what the child is learning. We'll enable you to understand and to appreciate what the child is learning. Make this an opening to deal with the parents as well. Especially coming to a bat mitzvah, you say to the parents, your child is going to go through a ceremony, something that's meaningful. That's a Jewish expression. You too ought to be part of it. You too ought to be able to appreciate it. When you do that, even if it's once a month, let's say for the year before the event takes place, you have 12 opportunities to sit with these people and talk to these people. Now. How you reach them about the differences between boys and girls, men and women, that's again a psychological matter. I remember when it was very fashionable for women to be inventing ways to do what the men do. And they had all sorts of kuntzim, you know, they'll get up and read the Torah. It's only a woman's minyan, so nothing wrong with reading in front of women. And the one woman won't make birchas haTorah when she gets up in the morning, so she can say birchas haTorah over the Torah. You know, I mean, it's like pseudo, right? Chazal say, "Have misrachet min akir or min adomalo." Distance yourself from what is ugly and from that which is similar to what is ugly. Don't. But it was very difficult. But I said to a women's group once, which did not endear me to them. I said to them, "I would have more respect for you if you, as women, would invent new forms, invent new activities. Why are you, with your inventiveness and creativity, just imitating the men? When you're imitating the men, what you're really saying is the men have it better, and we're only going to be full-fledged citizens if we do like the men. Why don't you invent your own? After all, the men's expressions aren't meant for you. They never were used for you. So invent something new and make it your own. Make it feminine." Right? So I think if you can express the idea that women are special in their own way, that women are prized, that women, and then say to them, look, this is a woman's expression. In our circles, women don't have to prove themselves by becoming men or looking like men or imitating men. That's not how we do it. We do it in a different way. I think that's, but that, if you have them for 12 sessions, and you can talk about these issues in the third session, in the fifth session, in the seventh session, so then by the time you get to the end, you can say that. If not, you of course have to draw your line and say, listen, you send your child to us, you have a relationship with us, you know what we stand for. We stand for 3,300 plus years of continuity. That's what we stand for. And we are proud of it, and we are happy to include you in our representation of that continuity. You know, that's what they call it, Jewish continuity. Right? That's the slogan of the people on the left, which, by the way, is a very pessimistic slogan. Continuity means I just don't want to lose any more. There's not a habamina of growth and development, expansion. You can say, listen, all these attempts to build Jewish continuity have been tried. They were tried 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, and they ended up in a historical dead end. We're here, Moshe Rabbeinu taught us, and we're still here 3,300 years later, living what Moshe Rabbeinu wanted. And that's what we have to offer. And we're happy to enable you to participate to whatever extent you can and you want to in this 3,000 plus year old tradition. And this is not part of it. This is not part of it. But you can build it up if you have a background. I think in schools also there ought to be requirements that the parents come once a week, once every other week, so to be able to share with the children. And the children shouldn't be distanced from their parents. That's something that no parent wants. And in that way, have an opportunity to communicate with the parents. The back. She wanted almanas to go to mikveh in order to. Okay. Yeah. Well, it is forbidden for a person, certainly an individual, to create new religious expression. That's certainly forbidden. Now, in this case, there was a time when it was acceptable for non-married women to go to mikveh. Indeed, they asserted it, as I understand, only a few hundred years ago, because it led to false assumptions about other activities which they thought they could do because they went to mikveh, which were usher anyway. There are many who have a minhag. In our circles, we have this minhag that women go Erev Yom Kippur. Even unmarried women go to mikveh Erev Yom Kippur, so as to prepare for Yom Kippur. So it isn't completely foreign as an idea, but to invent it, to apply it to a new situation, that would at least need a shaila to a gadol. One way that you can put it is this: you take whatever art form your student is familiar with. You just say, imagine a play by Shakespeare, and you think, why don't I rewrite this scene? You know, I'll write it differently. You know, after all, I think maybe it could go this way, it could go that way, and we'll get enough special emphasis in it. What would people say? Shakespeare was a gigantic genius. His words have been inspiring people for 400 years. How likely is it that your on the spot revision of Shakespeare is really going to improve it? Probably not. You don't have the genius of the Shakespeare. Our minhagim are woven together into a fabric. They reinforce one another. Each minhag is set in a deep context of halacha and hashkafa. And someone who's reading it on the surface and wants to graft it onto some psychological use, which seems to them reasonable, is going to be very, very likely taking it out of context and misusing it. So now, but of course, you can't know that. You have to consult with somebody who has that entire context in front of him, so that he can judge whether it's a reasonable application or isn't a reasonable application. I wouldn't forejudge it. I wouldn't say no, but I would explain the need to investigate it. A similar question, I know when I was becoming about tshuva, I thought to myself, well, I have one advantage. I'm not connected to any particular set of minhagim, so I will pick and choose the minhagim that I like. I mean, halacha is halacha. You have to do what you're told. But a minhagim, you know, that's only minhagim. After a few years of flailing around, I began to realize that the minhagim form a unity. Each one forms their sets of minhagim, and they form together an integrated unity. They're put together by ruchniistic geniuses, individuals, or communities. And it's extremely unlikely, I would say it's dead certain, that I'm not going to be able to put together that kind of integrated lifestyle. So then I said, okay, I can choose, which is, by the way, perfectly permissible. I can choose one, but I'm not going to invent one on my own because I haven't got that depth, that knowledge, that sensitivity. In the same way, you can give examples of this kind to the person and say, don't foreclose it, it might be. Let's get a Das Torah, someone who can represent the tradition through encyclopedic knowledge and sensitivity to discern whether it's an appropriate thing to do. Yeah. Brachos. Oh. No, well, that's of course that's a brachal about Tola. No, but you're talking now about people who do not define themselves as shomer mitzvahs.
Oh no, they do.
They define themselves as shomer mitzvahs. So then I would ask, which rav's opinion are they following? And if they give the name of a Rav, I would ask then, which one of the Gedolei Hador does this Rav take his psakim from? And say, that's how we do things. That's how we do things. You know, I mean, if I need surgery, I go to a doctor and I ask, was he certified in surgery? Who gave his diploma? Where did he train? Because I want surgery that will be good. Here I'm talking about my ruchnistic life. I have no less concern. Should have more concern about my ruchnistic life than I do about surgery. So I would put it that way to the person. I would say, you know very well that if it was a question of tefillin, or a question of kashrus of a chicken, or how to keep Shabbos, you wouldn't just invent it on your own. I feel that the daytime is more important than the nighttime. So I make kiddush on Shabbos in the daytime also. And I take it at night, I take it in the daytime also. Because I feel so. You would never have a minute to do that. So why do you think a Simchas Bas is any different from that? Right? If they think that the Shomer Mitzvahs, they have to learn the lesson of Das Torah. And so we do things, I'll pay an expertise that's recognized, and because we take it very seriously. I'll tell you, I heard a radio program in Israel, I was sick, listening to a talk program, and they were interviewing a representative of a Reform kibbutz in the south. So the interviewer said, what do you do when a question about keeping Shabbat comes up? Sprinklers, yes. Sprinklers, no. Fertilizer, mosquitoes. Well, how do you deal with that? He says, we understand that. We have a procedure. We assign three of our members to review Mishnayos, the Mishnayos of Shabbos, and give a report to the kibbutz. And usually we follow the recommendation of these three representatives. So I thought to myself, suppose there were a question about crop rotation, or land use, or irrigation. Would they assign three of their members to look at some journal articles and give a report? Absolutely not. They would pay good money to get an expert from the Tel Aviv University in agriculture to come down and give them an expert report, because crop rotation is money, and money's important. And Shabbat is a voluntary club, and it doesn't require much investment. So I think that's the attitude that we have to get across to people, that as important as you would feel an investment in the well-running of your company or the sanitary conditions in your house are, that's how we feel about doing service of the Eibishter correctly. And therefore, we run it on the basis of expertise. We don't make up our own opinions. Yes?
Girls who came from primarily to a Hasidic Rabbah community in Toronto.
went through the system as teenagers, were very inspired, got married, but now are really, they don't have any sort of inspiration. They wanted me to do a Taras Mishpacha review class, which I did, and the notes that I have were put together by, you know, Rob Miller, who's like the, you know, the head posek in Toronto. But as we're going through the notes, all of the girls learned from a Hasidish, you know, Taras Mishpacha instructor, and are telling me, well, what about this minhagim? I gave that up a long time ago, that whatever, there's different minhagim within the framework of Taras Mishpacha that are different from Hasidish. So my question is, if it's something that turned them off, these additional minhagim, once they found out that not everybody does that, how crucial is it that they hold, maintain those minhagim, given the fact that, I can't say it was almost, it's not forced upon them, but this was a community that was in the car at them. Or can I teach them, well, this is what the Shulchan Aruch says, or do I need to go above, you know, to explain to them the importance of maintaining those minhagim? Well,
who are their husbands?
Also, similar situation, Russian boys who are in the car also.
Through Babov.
Yeah. There's a Babov family in Toronto that brings in these Russian kids and sets them up financially and does everything for them, and then, you know.
And where do they daven?
Some of them have sort of distanced themselves a little bit, but they do. They'll ask the Babu or Rav for, you know, his halakhic opinion, but some of them are just finding it very... It was sort of like they got the halakha and the minhagim without all of the... You know, that's why they brought me in, thinking they need a hero professional to come and inspire them, you know, but...
Who brought you in?
The daughter of the Rav.
Oh, I see. Well, I think what you should do is this. First of all, you say... I don't know Hasidic minhagim. I'm ignorant of that, so I cannot tell you what they are, what they aren't. I cannot deal with that. I can teach you Shulchan Aruch. If you have a minhag which you mentioned to me, and I'll be able to understand it or have some insight into it, I'll be happy to share it with you. Otherwise, I just have to plead ignorance. I've been asked to teach you. I can teach you what I know. I can't teach you what I don't know. You are not in a position to say. You don't have to keep them in hugging. You're not in a position to say that you do have to keep them in hugging. That's not, I don't think that's what you have to pass judgment on. That they have to settle in the context of their own lives. And my guess is that for each couple, there'll be all sorts of ramifications. So whatever you say will not be shavah l'chol nefesh. It will not be equally applicable to all of them. So I think you should steer away from it as a subject and try to inspire them about the halachos as you understand them, as you've been taught them. And leave them and hug him out. I think it will be distracting. And if someone says, you know, there's this minhagim, but I don't do it anymore, let the comment drop, and don't deal with it. Don't deal with it. Let it go.
You said about the importance of keeping minhagim.
In general, yeah. But if you speak in general about the importance of keeping minhagim, and your students hear, oh, so I can't mention that to her because if I mention that, she's going to tell me it's a minhag and I have to keep it. Why put yourself in a position where they're going to presume your negative judgment on what they have to say?
Would there be enough community if they were not listening to the love over there anymore? The love over
up? There would be enough community. Let me explain this. I hinted at it before, but let me explain this. Every Jew has the right to attach himself or herself to whatever community he or she feels. There is no requirement that you have to keep them in hugging with your parents. There's no such requirement. You as women know that. When you get married, you marry a husband who has different minhagim, you switch him in hug him right away. The Gemara of Sochim talks about traveling, relocating to a new city. In those days, each city had its own community, its own Mora D'Asra, the one who was in charge of the halacha minhag for that city. And if you moved to a new city, you changed everything. Everything. Took on the new halachas, the new minhagim. There was no such thing as today we have this group and that group. So today, what you have is in one political environment, you have 20 cities, 20 communities. So you attach yourself to a community and you abide by the halachos and the minhagim of that community. It's what I was speaking about before. There's a minhagim. So I live in Yerushalayim. We have a boy coming up through our yeshiva, a Sephardi background, and wants to attach himself to Rav Avadia. So then he attaches himself to Rav Avadia and takes on all those minhagim. Nothing stops you from attaching yourself to whatever community you feel comfortable in. That's why I asked where the husband stopped. If they're inspired by Babov and then they've decided to become part of the Nei Israel community or something else in Toronto, so that they're not required to follow the Babov minhagim.
Don't they have to pick one rabbi and follow his derech?
They should. yes, it's appropriate to do that. And when you pick a Rav, you usually become part of his community. It would be pointless to pick a Rav and to be part of another community. Why would you do that? That's the normal development. Now, they're Balei Tshuva, they're in process. Who knows where they'll end up? If they have been brought in by Bubbav and attached themselves to a yeshiva community, then they follow the yeshiva menachim. They don't have to follow the menachim of the people who are makar of them. There's no connection. Just like you don't have to follow the menachim of your parents. Eventually, but if you're catching them in process, then don't force them to pick now.
They were following these menhagim, but sometimes they feel like they had a shaila, they don't want to call the rav because they know what the rav's going to say, and if they call another rav, then it's going to be easier for them.
Then they're in trouble. They're in process. You're dealing with people who have not yet found a niche that they feel comfortable in. Okay, so they're not in an ideal place. But you don't want to express yourself in such a way as to say, guess what? You're puzzled because you don't have a niche. That's not what you want to communicate. What you want to communicate is, I'm here for you, and I'm here to help you. If you have a problem, it is a problem. Taka, it's a problem. Now, don't give them solutions. First of all, I'm going to talk about that tonight with the other group. I can't remember what I'm doing. But it's very important to validate people and to say to people where you are is genuine and it's true, and for you it's a reasonable place to be in. So you haven't found a balanced niche. You haven't found a niche where you feel totally comfortable. Okay, I hope that you will be able to develop into that or find that. You should look for it and try to find it. But in the meantime, don't force them to make choices. Don't force them to confront their inabilities. They're in a difficult position.
What city are you in?
Palo Alto.
This is a Shaila, and I'm not a Rav to answer Shailas, but this is definitely a Shaila. And I hear the delicacy of the Shaila, because the minute you dissociate yourself from an activity like that, you will set up a rift that will last 364 days of the year. So we're not good enough, and you're not, and so forth and so on. On the other hand, what they're doing is plain out and out Isha. They're playing out now. With the Jewish content, it's also. Now it's obviously become like the Israeli holiday, which has no Jewish content either. You know, it's Yom HaMangal, barbecue day. That's what it is. It has no Jewish content whatsoever. I think that, by the way, what day did they celebrate it on? Hey or Vav? Vav, okay. At least they're up on that. It's a Nidche, right? I think it's a delicate shaila. It's a delicate shaila. And by the way, Palo Alto is a difficult case. What I'm telling you now is very important. If you have a shaila about what you're doing, not only is it preferable, but I would say it's almost mandatory to ask a local rav. Minadin, for a rav to paskin for another city, is very problematic. It's very problematic. Minadin. If a Rav in one city makes a psak, someone in another city may not be required to follow, no matter who he is. And certainly, if you have to face other people in your city and explain to them why you're doing what you're doing, if a Rav in your city said so, so then it carries weight. So somebody, someplace else, it doesn't carry weight. So it's very, very much preferable to go by what the psak of the Rav in your city. If there is no Rav in your city, I don't know what Palo Alto is like, whether they have any responsible about him or not. But if there isn't, then you have to ask somebody else. And then, but then it becomes quite sensitive, because as the Gemara says, you live in one city, your net is spread in that city also to catch what you want to catch. It's considered to be a questionable thing. I think that Piskei in the Pesachim of the Chazon Ish says you're not allowed to do that. It's very delicate. And you need an Odom. Baruch Hashem, the United States has poskim, has recognized poskim. You have to be in touch with the poskim and get a psak for that. It's a very, very difficult shaila. Yes, in the back. I have a couple of thoughts. I don't know if he'll do the whole job. I have a couple of thoughts. First of all, illustrating what I said before about meeting the person on his own ground, I tell people, I assume you're a liberal. I assume you believe in freedom. I assume you believe in self-determination. Now, at all times in history, there are more women than men. There are always more women than men. Why? Because men systematically kill themselves off. That's the way men are. They fight wars and they ride motorcycles and they do stupid things and they kill themselves off. So you, by enforcing monogamy, are guaranteeing that some women cannot be married. If a woman says, I would rather be a second wife to a man than be alone, who are you as a liberal to say no to her by law and stop her from doing what she wants to do? I thought you were a liberal. I thought you were in favor of each person living the life that he or she wants to live. You think there's room for mistreatment? Make laws against mistreatment. Knives can be used to kill people also. You don't outlaw knives. You outlaw murder. So that's what the first point that I make to put them a little bit on the defensive. You know, who are you to say no to what people want? Number one. Number two, polygamy in our tradition was always 10th class. The Avos had more than one wife only because their wives asked them to. I believe, I learned the Daf Yomi, which I've been through a few cycles. Perhaps you'll correct me, but I don't remember a single Tana or Amora who had more than one wife. Not one. Indeed, there's a very interesting story in the Gemara. In the times of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, it was customary, if you came from that kind of family, that there would be an erusin, and then the husband would go off to learn for 12 years, and then he would come back and complete the marriage. So Rabbi Yehuda and Nasi's son got married and went off to learn for 12 years. In the interim, the woman who was waiting for him became an akara. Rabbi Yehuda and Nasi said, what am I going to do? Tell my son to divorce her. People will say she waited for him, and this is what she got. Tell him to marry another wife. Listen carefully. People will say, this one is his wife and this one is his zona. Meaning, the one that waited for him is his wife and the one that's bearing him children is his zona. That's how they looked at polygamy. So he said, I can't do that. So he said, I have no choice. He prayed and she was cured. She became restored. So there's no question that polygamy was a matter of cases where the circumstances required it for whatever reason, but it was never looked upon as an ideal. Ashkenazi Jewry for more than 1,000 years, it became usur. We'll catch up. That's two things. Number one, from a liberal point of view, to outlaw it is absurd. And number two, from our point of view, was always regarded as second rate. If you talk about polyandry, which is one woman with many husbands, up until very, very recently, that meant the child will not know who his father is. For us, it's very important the child should know who his parents are. And the father won't know who his child is. So that's something which would be absolutely unacceptable to us. All of this that I've told you so far has really nothing to do with us. It has nothing to do with our values. Finally, if you ask why it's halachically asymmetrical in that way, from our point of view, it's because a man can satisfy the spiritual needs of more than one woman, and a woman cannot satisfy the spiritual needs of more than one man. The neshamas are made that way. The neshamas are made that way. So that even though it's second rate, polygamy is second rate, it's possible. Whereas the other way is not possible. At this point, what you have to say to the person is, that's the way God made us, and I can't tell you any more than that because I don't know any more than that. It's probably in the secrets of the Kabbalah, exactly why it works that way and how it works that way. But from our point of view, marriage is for the sake of the growth of both partners. And this is the way in which the growth of both partners can be best served. That, at that point, you have to take refuge in the tradition and in our own understanding of how Kadosh Baruch Hu made the world. But at least the objection to polygamy, which is made mindlessly on the basis of misunderstanding of social and political situation, that you can answer directly. It's a good question. You should ask other people as well. But that at least gives you something to talk about. Yes. Well, again, I think it's a shaila, but I can tell you my feeling about it. I really think you should ask someone. This is because everyone agrees it's better to live in Eretz Yisrael than not. The collective mitzvah, individual mitzvah, Muslim mitzvah, everybody agrees that you're better off in Eretz Yisrael than not. Question is, exactly how to define the mitzvah, what the echiyuv is, what you give up for it. But the halachos about leaving Eretz Yisrael for the sake of Ruchnius are quite clear. A man can leave Eretz Yisrael if he can learn better in Chutz La'aretz. Only better. There can be yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. His Rav that he relates to and he can be mekabel from is in Chicago. Then you should go to Chicago. He can leave Eretz Yisrael for that. If there's danger of sliding back into the old habits and the family connections which will absorb them back into the old habits, my feeling is that indeed they should be encouraged to stay. That our connection to Yiddishkeit is more important than living in the geography of Eretz Yisrael if you're not going to live up to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. In a way, it's worse because the standards in Eretz Yisrael are higher. You know, the idea of the land vomiting you out is only said about Eretz Yisrael, not said about Chicago or Detroit. So my feeling is that if you talk to the person about who they are becoming, what they're developing, what they're going to leave for their children, you know, what they're building for their children, what they're building for their family, it would be worthwhile to do that and stress to them that by going back, it's a drastic step. Yes.
Not firm enough. So sometimes they'll think that we have an agenda where, like, we want to grow the shul, so we need people to stay.
Well, it's an interesting and tricky point. We do have an agenda. That's the truth. Our agenda is that you should have the best. That's my agenda. My agenda is that you should have the best. I believe that we have the best. I believe that the Creator of the universe gave us the best. And therefore, I feel that every Jew has a right to have that heritage. You know, it's not just the heritage retreats, which are very good. And it's not just birthright trips to Israel where you can go play soccer. But it is really what belongs to you and that your life will be infinitely enhanced if you will hold on to this Eitz Chaim, this tree of life which is available to you. And if you have it in danger of losing it, then I would think six times before I did it. I think it's perfectly appropriate to say that. Yes.
I wonder if there are some suggestions for people who, though they may feel very emotionally invested in Yiddishkeit, have a very hard, difficult time taking tangible steps to move forward.
Yes, this is very, very important. Yeah, if you have an emotional attachment to Yiddishkeit, you find very difficult taking steps forward. This also, I didn't say to you. Maybe this is worth expanding on a little bit. You know this probably in the abstract, but because you asked this question, and all of you should really meditate on this. Every mitzvah can be subdivided. Every mitzvah can be subdivided. And can be subdivided into minute portions. And if a person says, wow, I just can't handle that. You say, okay, how about 3%? Can you handle 3%? No, 1%! Or, let's move to a different mitzvah and try 1% over there. So, we had a boy from Michigan State University who spent his first Jewish experience with us for 5 weeks. And he came to the end of the 5 weeks and he said, Shabbos was beautiful, but the top priority of Michigan State University is football. Number two is football. Number three is football. Number four is parties. Studies is 10 or 11. And he said to me, don't talk to me about football. That's Kodesh Kodashim, right? But on the other hand, I enjoyed Shabbos and I'd like to incorporate. That's what the rabbi is for, football versus Shabbos. So I said to him, keep Friday night. There are no football games on Friday night, as far as I know. Right? Now, make no mistake, Shabbos is 25 hours, period. None of this intellectual corruption. Poor God. If only God could have anticipated football, then he would have made some kind of, you know, some kind of exception for football. You know, but you know, how could you expect God 3,000 years ago? No, that's intellectual suicide. Shabbos is 25 hours, but if you can't keep 25 and you can keep 12, keep 12. Do what you can. Another fellow in his 40s, successful businessman, also was enthused about Shabbos. He said, Rabbi, Shabbos is business golf day. You have to play golf to negotiate business contracts and so on and so on. You can't skip that. So I said, what about one Shabbos a month? He said, well, okay, I don't have to be on the links every Shabbos. So good, I can keep one Shabbos a month. Now Shabbos is every 7 days since Prius Olam. There are no days off. But if you can't keep all of them, keep some of them. Davening. I remember when I was becoming a Baal Tshuva, I looked at the sitter and I said, okay, Shacharis will be from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Michal will be from 4 to 7, and Meir will be from 7 to 11. I'll go to sleep. It'll be my whole life. No, you start the other way. Not with the tefillos, but with time. How much time can you devote to davening? 11 minutes? Good. We'll show you what to say in 11 minutes. 13 minutes? You added 2 minutes? We'll show you what to say. Even the Siddurim's printed the hierarchy of more important things to say and less important things to say. You start with what the person can do, and you break down the mitzvah into tiny chunks. Lashon Hara. The person gets enthused about Lashon Hara. I recommend for women, if you have any desire to make progress in Lashon Hara, resolve from Lech Benchen until Kiddush. From Lech Benchen until Kiddush, it's an hour and a half. You've been mekabel Shabbos. You know what it feels like to light the Lech after a hectic Friday. And the hush falls over the house. And usually you're home with your children, so there isn't so much opportunity to speak Lashon Hara. But you get to Kiddush, I guarantee you it'll be a different Kiddush. Because you stand before the Ribbono Shel Olam and say, I accepted your Yom HaKadosh. And I made it Kadosh because I was careful with one of your most important mitzvahs. You know, on Rosh Hashanah, there are 100 tekiyos. 30 for Avodah Zarah, 30 for Ritzicha, 30 for Gilui Arayos, and 10 for Lashon Hara. That's how important it is. It's on a par with the most terrible crimes. So you say, okay, all the week is difficult, and I'm distracted, and I can't control it. But here, for this hour and a half, and you commit to Kiddush, it's a different Kiddush. There's a different shine. Then the Suda can be a hemshech of that, to whatever you can. So once a week, you know, yes, I did it. I'm in control. I'm serving the Ribbono Shel Olam. And from that, something else can grow. Take whatever steps are relevant for the person you're dealing with and break it down into something tiny. Oh, man, cover his head. Give me a break. I can't cover my head. Not even with a hat. It's unusual, abnormal. They'll look at me. Okay. So when you bench after you eat breakfast, at home, alone, cover your head for that. That's all. Once a day. Break it down. One blessing a day. You make your first drink of water in the morning. Make a blessing of that. The rest of the day, nothing. Just one. let him do something that enhances his own psychology, it enhances his own consciousness of what he's doing, and break it down. And you have to work hard to convince a person that small steps are very important. Talk about learning a language. This is a person very idealistic. I'm going to learn Chinese. Okay, how long is it going to be until you speak a whole Chinese sentence well? Months and months! So what do? Well, you learn character by character, and you stumble and you make mistakes. You expect that because it's a long project. This is also a long project. Be happy with little steps. Break it down into little manageable steps. The person say, oh, yes, I could handle that. With that kind of self-confidence, you can build. Yes?
I'm sure a lot of people in the room have this experience. So some of our participants or ex-singles get comments from friends and family that they're in a cult. So being that I have no experience with cults, what might be a good response that we could coach our people to offer to deflect this claim?
Okay. First thing is, one characteristic of a cult is that it doesn't allow contact with other points of view. And I would recommend to say to the person who accuses you of being in a cult, does your society allow contact with our point of view? You're accusing me of being in a cult and thereby telling me I shouldn't have contact with this point of view. Sounds to me like your culture doesn't allow contact with this point of view. It sounds to me like you're sitting in the cult. We had this in Or Sameach all the time. The boys would go to kibbutz, and the kibbutz would say that they're in a cult. So we taught them to say back, but look, Or Sameach allowed me to come to you. You just won't allow your members to come to Or Sameach. So who's functioning as a cult? That's one, I think that's enough to start. A little deeper, what is wrong with a cult? It's very interesting. About 25 years ago, the Attorney General's Office of the Israeli government sent a representative to Or Sameach and to other yeshivas because they wanted to frame an anti-cult law, and they didn't want the Baal Tshuva yeshivas to be included as cults. Very enlightened of them. So it's like a labor government. It's almost shocking. So they sent out assistant attorney generals to consult with the yeshivas how they could write a law against cults which wouldn't include us. And it sparked a discussion among the faculty, how to deal with this. It's a long story, but the bottom line was this. There are only two features of cults which are not shared by universities and football clubs and the army and political parties and other things that you think are okay. Those two features are fraud and coercion. If they lie about what they're advertising, what it is that they're trying to provide, the service they're trying to provide, like the Moonies in Israel advertise clubs to improve the civility of Israeli society, which is the lost cause anyhow. But, and then they tell you later that you have to worship Reverend Moon. Right? Fraud and coercion, being cut off from communication, being cut off from your family, not allowed telephone or internet service, and so on and so on. Those two features are genuinely objectionable features of cult. Teaching values, teaching a new worldview, that happens in university. That happens in summer camp. That happens in political parties. You can't outlaw that. If you call that culty and you're going to outlaw it, you'll outlaw all sorts of activities that are perfectly acceptable. You become one-dimensional. Isaac Stern practiced the violin 12 hours a day. That meant that he was somehow unfortunate because he devoted himself to the violin and only the violin. I mean, all these types of social and political and psychological insights, if you think a little bit, you'll see whatever critique they have of us, it would mean universities are no good, and political parties are no good, the army's no good, and football teams are no good. Once you do that, you can disqualify all the other critiques. The only two critiques that remain are fraud and coercion, and I would invite them to come in and take a look. No parent has ever survived with hostility a trip to a yeshiva or a seminary. They have not survived it. We had one case, I used to teach in Be'er Yerushalayim, of a father who was sure that his daughter had been absorbed into a cult. And he went to deprogramming classes. He went to months of deprogramming classes. And then he came to Eretz Yisrael to rescue his daughter. So he said to her, Is it possible to have a meeting with the charismatic cult leader? So they arrange a meeting with Rabbi Refson, you know, which the charismatic cult leader. Can I attend some of the secret cult sessions? Does he want to come to classes? Like a shy, you know, the room's open. All right. Then get your child out of the clutches of the cult talker. Can we go traveling? They rented a car. They went to the north for a week. You know, they had a wonderful time. The result was that he went home and made his house kosher. So you say to them, if you think it's a cult and you aren't lily-livered, you know, you aren't afraid to take a look, come and take a look. I challenge you. Take a look for yourself. See with your own eyes whether it's really a cult or not. No parent has ever survived that. They always come back with a positive impression. Our institutions make very good impressions. So I don't think that you have to worry about it. Yeah?
Not so much with our students. We're on campus, but with, you know, sort of extended students who are a little older. There are a lot of women who have become from and, or more or less from, and are having difficulty finding a shidduch. And it's heartbreaking, especially since we've encouraged them to become more religious with sort of the idea that, you know, you go to Neve and you come back and you'll find your shidduch. You know, not that I promised anything, but, you know, I felt deep inside that it certainly wasn't going to make it worse. But in a way, maybe it is harder. I don't know. The pool is so limited once the girl gets to, like, 32. You know, I don't know how to respond to them or give them chizuk or just give myself chizuk about what's going on.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
I have some girls who are so desperate. They say, what's wrong if I would, I mean, it's become acceptable today if I would, you know, just, you know, go to the sperm bank and I want to have a chocolate, but I don't want to be sound bad, and I don't really know how to counsel them. It's breaking for them.
Okay, the latter question I'm just not qualified to answer. I can't, and should ask Rabbi Tatz. I mean, medical halacha is his specialty, and he probably has an answer for that. I have no answer for it. First of all, I think your first answer was right. There's no reason whatsoever to think that had they stayed not religious, that they would have done better. Indeed, as my son who was counseling somebody said to the person, so your heart tells you that this is the person that you want. There's a whole world of people who are making their decisions on the basis of their hearts. Are they doing well? Are their marriages working out well? Not really. If the divorce rate is 50% and some of the marriages are unhappy, so then it seems like following your heart is not a good prescription for happiness. It's not a good prescription for marital success. So to think, well, she probably would have found somebody, yes, and she probably would have ended up divorced, and, you know, with or without a child. And so I don't think you have to feel guilty that you made her from and made it harder. Especially when we know that Kadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgacha is the one that determines whatever's happening. I think to answer them, you know, it's a little bit like, you have some sort of physical problem, and the doctor says, take this medicine. Take the medicine, and it doesn't get any better. So you go back to the doctor and say, doctor, it didn't work. He says, you're making a mistake. Without the medicine, it would have been worse. The medicine is working fine, because you didn't get any worse. Whether something's beneficial always depends upon what would it have been like without that thing. So there's certainly no reason to think that their lives would have been better lives without. Together with that, you can, I mean, misery loves company is something which we say as well. The shidduch situation is terrible. It's terrible for people who were trained to Beis Yaakov. It's terrible for people in Me'ashorim. It's terrible largely because, as the Gedolim have pointed out over the last 5 years, women insist on marrying older men. And men insist on marrying younger women. Do you understand why that's a problem? Because the population is expanding. So the number of 22-year-olds is smaller than the number of 18-year-olds. There are more 18-year-olds than 22-year-olds. So if 22-year-old men are only going to marry 18-year-old girls, some of the 18-year-old girls are not going to get married. And the only way to solve that is to reverse it. In Baltimore, they have an incentive program where they pay money to couples where the husband is younger than the wife. Now, it's hard for the girls because the girls are typically more mature than the boys. And they don't want to pick up a baby off the street. On the other hand, she could bring him up. After all, the purpose of an Eishes Chayil, I'll tell you one word, then we have to quit. I'll tell you one last word, then we have to quit. This I heard from Rav Mendel Weinbach. Beautiful, beautiful word. You could use this at Sheva Brachas. Ever since I heard from him, I've used it many, many times. The Gemara in Yevamah says that, I forget which Tana it was, Eliyahu Navi appeared to him, and he asked Eliyahu Navi a question. One question. He said, Bameh ozaraso ha'isha labal. The Torah calls an isha an ezer kenegdo, a helper. Why does she help him? So he said, Eliyahu Navi said, a man brings home wheat. Can you eat wheat? She makes bread out of it. A man brings home flax. Can you wear flax? No, she makes clothes out of it. Nimso, she mamidoso araglov umeiro es enov. She stands him on his feet and enlightens his eyes. So Rav Mendel asked two questions about this Gemara. Number one, if you had one shot at Eliyahu Navi, is that the question you would ask? What does a woman do in the house? How does she help her husband? That's the question you want to ask. Number two, what does it mean that she stands him on his feet and enlightens his eyes? She's making food and clothes. Okay, fine. Says Rav Mendel, the message of the Gemara is that it's the man who's wheat and the man who's flax. It's the man who's the unfinished product. He's the unfinished product. And her job is to make him into a finished product. Whatever he becomes because of what she did for him. And if the response is that therefore she's secondary because her job is only to make him develop into what he develops, to that I have two answers. And with this I really will quit. Because there's an infinity of things to say. There are two things to say to that, which was a common complaint, that the woman exists only to enable the man to develop. Well then, that means if A's job is to make B develop, then A is somehow subservient, less important, less valuable. So then pity the poor psychiatrist. What does a psychiatrist do? The guy comes in and he says, Doc, every night before I go to sleep, I have to wash my hands 106 times. It's a washing compulsion. Save me, Doc! I don't want to wash my hands 106 times! So he saves him. So what's going on? Psychiatrist is saving him! So then the psychiatrist is just a toady, you know, he's just a slave. He's helping to save other people. And what about every doctor? And what about every social worker? And what about every psychologist? What about every teacher? Every teacher is teaching younger people things that the teacher already knows, so he's just doing it to make the younger people more conversant, more educated. So pity the poor teacher. Is that right? Do we think that psychiatrists and doctors and social workers and teachers are somehow unfortunate? They're spending their professional lives in a second-class situation? I don't think we think that way. This is the answer in secular terms. We don't think that way about people. More, you're going to get a job, and somebody's going to pay you a salary. Why do you think they're going to pay you a salary? Because your work is going to earn more money for them than your salary. Otherwise, they're not going to pay you. So you're really a slave. You're really a toady. You're just making more money for them. Does anybody think that way? No, nobody thinks that way. That's from the secular point of view. But from the religious point of view, this question is poison. It's poison. And what is the creator of the universe doing other than providing for us? Does it really make you less? If you step into the Ribbono Shel Olam's shoes, so to speak, and do what he does, that makes you less. It makes you secondary. He created the whole world to give to us. You don't have to quit so quickly. to say that because I'm dedicated to enabling somebody else to achieve, therefore I'm secondary, that's absolute poison. So that's the creativity of the canvas on which you paint your picture for a woman primarily is her husband. Now, of course, when you're talking to women who aren't married, that's a very, very difficult message. And all you can say is that the Ribbono Shel Olam has a setup for the world, and not everybody's world functions the same way. Many Gedolim were childless. Go explain that. Go explain that. I had the great privilege of learning with Rav Shalevsky. And no children there. One of the great gedolim of Torah. And doesn't happen. So, Satmar Rav, Zechat Sarev, Tzorah Kodesh, Lavrocha. His daughter died in his lifetime. He left over no one. So, our job is to do the best we can with what we have. And to sympathize and to say that this is a problem everywhere, and we are all aware of it, and we daven about it, and it hurts all of us, and to daven for Yeshua. Okay, I'm told that there's somewhere time. I will stay for a little more time. Yeah.
Very often, I think I'd like the Rebbe to articulate, I guess, an answer to a question that I hear very often. That people find when a family or either a child becomes frum and goes back to their parents, or a family becomes frum and goes back to the non-frum family, that we're restricting ourselves. We can't eat with them. We can't be with them. We can't partake in things depending on your level of frumkeit. So you're going to always have certain gedarim where you cannot, or you choose not to, be part of the family dynamic because of those decisions. And so obviously people always, say, well, if we want shalom bayis and we care about each other, etc., you can imagine what is said. I guess, what is the response to that person? Because we are restricting ourselves and we are setting up barriers. Obviously, you could tell them, your child will hopefully be mechabed you better, and that they're earning zchuyos, whatever. But that doesn't necessarily answer them. Actually, they're not even looking for an answer,
that's quite true.
What's the right?
Look, I don't know exactly what stage you are raising the issue, but let me try to tell you what can be done that will stave off this issue. We counsel, my Rebbe Zatzal, or Sameach, others that I know about, we all know about, when a child becomes frum, to spend Shabbos at home. Let's say the child comes home from university, or comes back from Israel, whatever it is, at least half the Shabbos should be spent at home. With the television going, and the VCR, and the going in and out in the cars, and the cell phones and everything else, to spend Shabbos at home. Kashas can be taken care of, double wrap and tinfoil, and all the rest of it. Spend it at home. Participate in every family activity that you can participate in. For two reasons. Number one, you're sending a message. Yiddishkeit is not separating me from the family. Maybe Saturday afternoon, they'll all go out in the car. Then you left me. I didn't leave you. I came home to spend time with you. Second of all, when you do that, when you have to say no, you have credibility. Because you could say, very well, I spent Shabbos at home. That it's not, for me, the most inspiring environment. Not the environment that I would find together with people who want to do what I'm doing. But I felt the family is more important. So when it comes to this, I hope you'll believe me that this I cannot do. By the way, a second thing to do is suggest family activities that are kosher family activities. Whether it means going to a children's museum, or whether it means going for a barbecue in the forest, or whatever it is, suggest them and say, let's do this together. Where you're the one, you, the child, are the one who's initiating a togetherness activity for the family. And that shows you that you are not against You're not against the family, not against unifying with the family. We had a boy in the yeshiva when I first came 30 years ago. He was there for a year, became frum. I came in January. He was going home for the summer. Father was wealthy. And he was going to spend the summer at home. And he said to me, what should I do? So I said, what does your father like to do? He said, well, my father loves to play golf. I said, you suggest playing golf with your father. He said, Rabbi, hitting a ball into a hole with a stick? And I'm not good at it either. But I'm going to spend 2 hours banging a ball around. I said, trust me. Go home and go and don't wait for him to ask you. You suggested you go and play golf together. He came back. I said, how did it go? He said, well, I took your advice. We played golf 3 times. Before I left, my father said to me, I respect you. I said to him, wasn't 3 golf games worth those 3 words? I respect you. Children write home from yeshiva or from seminary. They're becoming frum. Right? What is the letter filled with? Do you know what I learned? Do you know what I did? Do you know where I went? Do you know what I heard? Do you know what I experienced? End of communication. What's the You know the difference between the message and the meta message? You've learned that distinction? The message is what it says. And the meta message is what's implied by saying that. If I ask you a question, so the message is, what's the answer to this question? The meta message is, I think you're knowledgeable. I think you're kind enough to spare your time and intelligence to help me. That's a meta message, right? The meta message in such a letter is, what's happening to me is interesting and important and fascinating and developmental, and your lives are zero. Because the child isn't asking about the parents. You tell this to the child, I've told this to students, say, but their lives really are zero, you know. They're doing nothing. They're doing the same thing they've always done. Yes, but they aren't zero to them. And if you don't show any interest in them, then they'll say, you're just not interested in us as people. So what should I ask them about? What is your father like? He likes baseball? Ask him what's happening in baseball. Because you're sending the message, Dad, if you're interested in that, I'm interested in you. So I want to hear what you have to say about that. That's the message, that's the meta message when you ask such a question. So building these kinds of connections, building these kinds of bridges with the family can stave off that sense of division that will come later. We have had, in a few cases, tragic marriages where the parents refused to come to the marriage. That's absolutely tragic. Because a wedding, I don't have to tell you, a Yiddish wedding is a very powerful opportunity to make a gigantic Kiddush Hashem. Usually the parents have never seen anything like it. They can't imagine anything like it. If you would describe it to them in words, they would say it would be murder. And when they attend it, the Kiddush in it is just, it's all, I don't have to tell you. About it. So they come and they have that kind of experience. Then a positive bond is made. Then when the married couple or even with a child, so then you go and you participate as much as you can. You invite the parents to your house. And the children will say, but why doesn't Zadie do this? Why doesn't Zadie do that? You explain to them. He didn't have the schools that you had. Our Bechor said to my father, Olav Shalom, he said, when he was five, I guess, four or five, he said, what did they call, they called him? Come with us to shul, Shabbos morning. And my father said, no. So he said, come with us to shul. I'll tell you stories. You can imagine how I felt as a parent of a child who wants his grandfather to come with him to shul. You know, so he'll do, what can I do to him? I'll tell him stories. But this is what you want. You want this kind of connection. You don't want the child to feel that his grandparents are enemies. Chas v'shalom. You want to feel love and respect for them as people and a sense of pity that they didn't have the opportunities that you have. By the way, pity is a wonderful instrument to build up a barrier. Pity is a wonderful instrument to build up a barrier because no one wants to be an object of pity. No one wants to feel that other people pity him because if other people pity him, it means he's in a bad situation. He's really unfortunate. Nobody wants to feel that way. So if you teach your child to pity someone, what he internalizes is, and I don't want to be like that, because I don't want people to pity me either. It's a wonderful way to build up a barrier. It's very common in some places. I don't know if you have this sickness. You see people driving on Shabbos, and they say, ah, they're goyim. Okay, a lot of people who do drive are goyim. But some of them are Jews. We taught our children, even when we lived in Baltimore, you don't say that. Chas v'shalom, they're not goyim, they're yidden. They're Yidden who didn't have an education. They're Yidden who didn't have an opportunity. They're Yidden who are unfortunate. Our house faces the Jerusalem Bnei Brak highway. Some people think it goes to Tel Aviv, but we know better. It goes to Jerusalem Bnei Brak. Right? And of course, it's going on Shabbos. We call it unfinished business. It's unfinished business. Those Jews are Jews. You know, there are the religious Jews and the not yet religious Jews. Those are the two groups that we face. So you want to build the bridges beforehand, so that the family, the non-religious part of the family, never feels that you're against them, you're separating from them, you're setting up. And then, when there are restrictions, you look for ways to go around them, or look for some alternative way in which you can be together. Or you say to them, we love you, we would love to be with you, this we cannot do. And because you have participated so many times in the past, you have credibility when you say that. It's very, very important. Yes?
What message do you give to children if you're dealing with someone who's not trusted? Not just over their banadura, but their real kofar. we have a crazy situation, a Mishkan Zachar pair who one of them is, quote unquote, an Orthodox rabbi, and he holds that it's not. That it's not that it's, this is not what the Rosh Hashanah, that it's not 26:13. I mean, like, yeah. Real. So, what message should you give your children? How do you explain?
I would hope you could keep it from your children.
It's
if it's isn't prophesia, then I believe this is emes tikatar hashkafa. What you should say to the person is what the person is doing is wrong, and as far as the person is concerned, only Kodesh Baruch Hu can judge. Only a Kodesh Baruch Hu can judge. It's not my business to judge the person's neshama and what will happen to him in Olam Haba. That's none of my business. I can only tell you that the actions that he's performing are wrong actions. They're definitely wrong actions. I'll leave it at that. Yeah. Is anybody else who hasn't asked yet? You didn't ask a question yet?
I did ask a question already. So.
Who has? Someone wants to go first time before we go second time around? Okay. Second time. Yeah. Yeah? Okay. Here.
Exactly. I had a phrase of question, but we have two intermarried couples. The wives are Jewish. One of them had a baby, one of them is expecting. They're very interested. They come to our classes. They're really, really interested. The husbands are not interested. I guess, well, the first question is one of them really wanted to learn Torah Mishpacha with me. She wanted to go to the mikvah. I spoke to Dov Cohen. He said no. So, I guess how to say it to her without hurting her, because she knows I'm teaching all her friends. And B, how much to invest in these women when it's not like their husbands are interested in becoming Geirim, but on the other hand, their kids are going to be Jewish. So,
did Rav Dov Cohen tell you why he said no? Or what?
Because whenever she comes home, it's when she's a big Geirim.
And the truth is, Lagabi, a goyish husband,
right.
Nita is nothing.
Right.
So,
I'm encouraging that relationship.
Right. That's interesting. That's why it's important to ask a godel. You know, I would never have thought of that. I guess. What you can say to her, let me back up and say something. I mean, I don't know, who am I speaking to tonight? It's not this group, right? So there's no overlap in this. No, don't do that. You've had enough of me today. There's one thing that's very important. In every interaction, whether it's a question, advice, teaching, when a person expresses an opinion, and it's called validation. You heard, the Sefer of Eov, Book of Job. Three friends came to him. Say Chazal, they sat with him for a week in silence. Think about this. They sat with him for a week in silence. What were they doing? They waited for him to open up, and that's where we learn the halacha, that the oval should start the conversation. But still, what were they doing by sitting there for a week in silence? These are three people who have lives. They have what to do. Sitting there with him said, we recognize that you're suffering a great tragedy. You're not exaggerating. We don't think you're foolish. We don't think that you're unworthy of our attention. No, it's worthwhile for us to take a week out of our lives and just sit with you to tell you that we think that what's going on here is worthy of our attention, our sacrifice. It's called validation. When a person says something, the first thing you want to do is validate the person. So, let's say the person says, ABC. Say, I think B is right on the third Thursday of every odd month. You know, I can agree with that. Find something to agree with, number one. Always try to, if you can at all, find something to agree with. Then the part you can't agree with, you can say, I can understand how someone with your education and your life experience and your talents would see it that way. Notice those are all positive terms. Education, life experience, talents. And I'm hoping that you could understand how someone with a different education and a different life experience could see it differently. Then you're only asking for equal time. You're only asking for equal recognition. You're not saying you're wrong because. That opens the person up. Most people are fair-minded. If you're accepting the naturalness, all you say is natural. You didn't say it was right, it says natural. If you're accepting the naturalness of their point of view, then they should be equally willing to open to accept the naturalness of your point of view. That's a way of being able to get yourself heard. Start by validating the person. It shows you I'm on your side. I'm not out to get you. I'm not out to oppose you. Now, in a case like this, the first thing I would do... here's another beautiful illustration I heard from Rabbi Taub in Baltimore. It's a Chodesh Rosh we had the privilege to be connected with. You give your child, your six-year-old, ice cream cone. And the ice cream falls out of her hands and onto the floor. And she's bawling her eyes out. So what do you say? Oh, don't cry. It's nothing. We'll get you another one. That's a big mistake. That child's world has dissolved. And you're thinking of a piece of ice cream. No, she was holding it and she dropped it and it's gone. Said to Rav, get down on your knees. So your face is on level with her. I said, boy, you must be very unhappy. That must hurt you a lot. The child says, oh, you're on my page. Yes, yes, I'm very unhappy. Yes, it hurts a lot. Then you can talk about getting another one. This holds with adults as well. Adult comes to you with a problem. They say, that's your problem. This is your lucky day. You came to the right person. I have the answer. Here's the answer. Well, if this person is a serious problem, this person has been thinking about it for months, this person doesn't think it's a snap. And this person says, if you think it's a snap, you haven't got it. You don't know what my problem is. I'm not stupid. I've been thinking for a while. This isn't so simple. So, if you want to get the other person's credibility, what you say is, wow, that's really a problem. You must really be in pain. That must be very hard to bear. So, first of all, you're validating the person. If you say you have the answer like that, what you're communicating, the meta message is, why are you so upset? You shouldn't be so upset. It's a simple answer. You know, you take care of it, it'll be nothing. The meta message crushes the other person. You say to the person, wow, that's a difficult problem. And if you say, even if you have the answer, let me think about it. You call up 2 days later and say, you know, I've been thinking about your problem for the past 2 days. And she says, right, you've been thinking about it. It's a tough problem. I knew it was a tough problem. You know, I know it's difficult. And you say, I'm not sure this will help, but it seems to me that you might try this. Then you have a listening ear because you're validating the other person. It's very, very important as a basis for communication. Now, in this case, I would start with that kind of validation. I know it must hurt you. Your friends are in the class, and you're not in the class, and so on and so on. And then what you can say is, in Jewish thinking, sometimes things are a package deal. And without the package, the pieces not only don't help, but they can hurt. And it's only the people who are great scholars who can tell what is a package deal and what isn't a package deal. I consulted with one of the country's biggest scholars, and he told me that this piece doesn't fit into your present package. It's not where you're holding. There are other things that we could talk about and work on. But for you, this piece isn't the right piece. I'm not enough of a scholar myself to explain to you exactly why it's not a right piece. But that's the advice that I've gotten from a person who's recognized worldwide, David Cohen, recognized worldwide as a scholar. And he told me, this piece does not fit into your present reality. I'll leave it at that. Okay.